writing, I actually cannot be anti-Semitic because black people are actually Jews. He added, you guys, meaning the Zionists, have toyed with me and try to blackball anyone who opposes your goals. West also posed a thought-provoking question. Have you ever wondered why, among all ethnic groups in history, Jews have consistently faced oppression or anti-Semitism from host societies? He argued that Judaism, as a religion or ethnicity, is not the core issue. Ordinary Jews, like followers of other religions and ethnicities, live peacefully in various societies. The problem arises when a religious or ethnic group refuses to coexist equally with others and instead seeks to separate itself, demanding a larger share of public resources. Naturally, any group attempting this path will face resistance from the majority. Throughout history, Zionists have shown that nationality holds no meaning for them. Regardless of where they were born or raised, they ultimately pursue the interests of exclusivist Judaism. Protecting their inner circle and establishing a greater Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates takes precedence over everything else. Today, Israelis, as the infantries of the Zionist movement, have turned a deaf ear to global logic and protests. As Chinese statesmen have said, Israel has made itself deaf. This is previously why Jews have historically been accused of disloyalty and betrayal by various societies and ethnic groups, leading to their expulsion. As Jamie Foxx, the famous American actor and singer, stated, Jews killed Christ. What do you think they'll do to you? Foxx shared this statement with the hashtags fake friends and fake love, referring to alliances with Zionism. Of course, it is important to note that there are Jews, such as the Jewish community in Iran, who remain loyal to their homeland and distance themselves from Zionism. Especially in a land where Zionist media giants have portrayed Iran as an anti-Semitic country to the world. During the height of the 2023 Gaza War, BBC Persian published a report titled, What is the Difference Between Anti-Semitism and Anti-Zionism? This approach by the BBC Persian was noteworthy because acknowledging the distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism was previously unheard of in mainstream Western media. This discourse was essentially unrecognized as it could dismantle the Zionist strategy of labeling and discrediting supporters of Palestine. If, in the past, the refusal of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the famous American basketball player, to visit the occupied territories was seen as a symbolic slam dunk against Israel, today, Kyrie Irving's support is like a game-winning three-pointer in the final seconds. Al-Quds, the first Qibla for Muslims and the holiest city for Jews and Christians, has now become a political focal point for the world and even a gateway to spiritual enlightenment. An example is Yang, a talented American basketball player. After participating in the Palestinian Basketball League and experiencing the hospitality of Palestinians, he decided to convert to Islam during Ramadan and change his name to Ahmed.
Ashhadu anna la ilaha illallah.
It is likely that this trend of global figures, especially athletes and artists, embracing Islam, which provokes the enemies of global peace, leading to occasional waves of Quran burnings in Western countries. The ancient land of Iran has always been a cradle of legends who stood against the darkness. Ali Dai, the second highest goal scorer in the world after Ronaldo, is one of the thousands of legends. During the 2014 Gaza War, he tied his dreams to those of Gaza's children, wishing them a future without bombs. A wish that remains unfulfilled to this day. In just 45 days of the 2023 Gaza War, nearly 5,000 children, one child every 7 minutes, was killed by the Zionist regime. On November 19, 2023, the 44th day of the Gaza War, Israel began its day not with bombs of resistance, but with the bombshell news of Kyrie Irving. Irving appeared at a press conference wearing a Palestinian keffiyeh, surprising the journalists. The Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv headlined, "Dressed in a keffiyeh, Kyrie Irving once again shows solidarity with Palestinians." The paper added that the Dallas Star, who had previously expressed anti-Zionist views and supported Palestinian struggles, appeared before and after the game against Milwaukee in traditional Arab attire to pay tribute to Gaza. The Al-Aqsa Flood Liberation Operation has achieved significant outcomes. This operation, which broke through the walls of Gaza, often referred to as the world's largest open-air prison, can aptly be described as a prison break. Just a month before this operation, we witnessed a daily and escalating trend of Quran burnings in Western countries, nations that claim to respect all religions. 40 days later, verses from the Quran, specifically from the Surah At-Tawbah, were recited openly at the United Nations.
I saw the modern manifestation of what is found in the Surah Al-Tawbah of the Holy Quran, and I quote, "And if anyone seeks your protection, then grant him protection so that he can hear the words of God, and then escort him where he can be secure." End of quote.
This is particularly striking given the United Nations, the very institution that facilitated the creation of the illegitimate Israeli state, has remained silent in the face of Quran burnings. The recent events surrounding the Al-Aqsa flood operation sent a clear message to Zionist supporters. Do not bet on a losing horse, especially if that horse has been wounded in the flood. The Zionists are terrified and hope that the fate of this horse does not resemble that of the sick and losing horses in Hollywood films where their American owners deliver the final shot.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and a very warm welcome. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host Zainab, and today we have in our studio our guest speaker, Brother Liaquat Abbas. Well, dear listeners, Brother Liaquat is a research scholar in the House of Miafkum, having a specialization in the field of psychology and also studying the religious studies. However, in this program, we invite our experts to gives advices on the Islamic upbringing topics. The answers are mostly rooted in the Holy Book of Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and also the traditions from holy imams. Well, we talked about a lot of factors that lead to poor motivation, but what about the strategies to overcome this issue? We're going to explore that today with Brother Liaquat. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam, sister.
A very warm welcome again.
Thank you so much.
So we explored, you know, a lot of factors that lead to poor motivation. Sometimes it was family pressure, sometimes it were other things, sometimes it was like bullying, sometimes it was social isolation,
yes.
Sometimes we were traveling here and there, and unfamiliarized environment, and so many other things.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the strategies that we can actually apply to make this motivation better for a teenager?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. So just like we have said, setting up short goals and long-term goals is very important, which will help the teenagers set clear and achievable goals. It's
right.
They are measured, okay? They can be achieved. And the teenager has the capacity, has the capability to achieve that particular goal in this particular time period, okay? And of course, long-term goals are very important, and of course that will give a sense of direction. Like, it will provide direction, and of course it will create a sense of purpose.
Yeah.
In the teen, okay?
Yeah.
So example, I am pursuing medical.
Yeah.
I'm in my medical stream, okay, or any other stream like psychology, okay? So because I know in my long term I'm gonna get this kind of job, okay?
Right.
So my sense of purpose is there. Like, okay, because of I'm studying in medical, I'm gonna become a doctor. Okay, even in doctor, if I'm going into example, I'm having inclination towards heart, example.
Yeah.
Then I'm gonna become a heart surgeon, okay?
Right.
Or physiotherapy or whatever, okay? So setting up short goals and long goals are very important for motivation.
Right. Hey, I would like to add something. Like you said, setting up short goals and long-term goals. Here, sometimes teens, what do they do? They mix up the primary goals with the sub-goals, or I would say the main goals with the sub-goals. And that's where they fail. That's where the motivation lacks again. But Rumi says it, Maulana Rumi says that, he says in Persian, agar sad amat navad ham pish mas, which means like if 100 is with us, then definitely 90 is with us. Like if you have a focus on a main goal, then definitely sub goals come under this particular category.
Definitely. You know, unfortunately, if we ask a lot of kids, a lot of children, a lot of teens, what is your purpose? What is your goal? What do you want to become when you grow old? They're clueless. They're like, okay, right now I'm studying this.
Yeah.
But they don't know why they are studying.
They don't know, yeah.
You know, this is a very bad thing. Like, this
so
is
even
a
if
very
they are young, they should know the purpose.
Yeah. At least a kind of path, okay?
Right.
Example, okay, after this, I'm going to go into this stream. After that, I want to go into this stream, example.
Yeah.
Will make the person feel that, okay, I'm studying because of a purpose.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm not just studying just like that.
Yeah.
I'm studying, okay, in order to go into this particular stream, and connecting it with your end goal. Example, I'm studying mathematics, I'm studying physics right now, because this is useful in my later stage, okay,
yes.
Over here,
right?
Okay, for whatever reason,
so
connecting it will help even more that the teen progress in that particular field.
Right.
So setting up goals. Achievable goals, manageable goals, measured goals, short goals, long goals are very important.
Right.
If a person is doing this, then of course motivation can build up very easily and quickly.
Right. Let's take a short break here and let's explore on more strategies after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir.
Welcome back. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat Abbas is here with me in the studio, and we are exploring the strategies to improve motivation in our children. For now, we said that set up goals, long-term and short-term goals, and also the main goals and sub-goals. And never confuse or mix up between the sub-goals and main goals, because if main goal is with us, the sub-goals are going to come automatically. Yeah. Yes.
So the second one is fostering independence, which is very, very important.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this is what the like today's teen lack. The teenagers lack it, unfortunately, or even the children. So fostering independence, the meaning itself says this, that encourage them, like your teens, your children, to take ownership of their choices and decisions.
Right.
Okay. Which will definitely enhance their motivation. You know, of course, this has limits. When you are saying that, okay, to take ownership of their choices, it shouldn't be like whatever choice they want to.
Yeah.
They can go into it. Example, they can't go into a stream which is like, example, haram.
Yeah.
Example, music industry, which pertains
yeah,
with haram.
Yeah.
With into a kind of industry which supports haram, okay,
yes.
Which is forbidden, okay, or into an industry which is really not like which doesn't have a lot of scope,
yeah.
Okay, for whatever reason, okay, this is like this should be discussed, this should be put forward, like you know, there are few jobs. Example, which definitely will bring a lot of income, okay? Even if we feel that, oh, you know what, this kind of job, what is this kind of job? This job is cheap, example, okay? But still, because we haven't explored it and it's not haram even, so that still can be put, can be taken up by the teen, example, himself or herself. Let's get into an example to make it more lively, and that is I would say carpentry. Okay, carpentry
right.
is a kind of job which a few parents might see that it's a kind of cheap job, or it's a kind of a job which brings a lot of shame or something like that. Okay, but if
this
we
is
see
something that does not suit my child.
Yeah, example. Okay, but the child is really interested into it. Okay. He really likes cutting things and stuff.
Skillful
like
things.
Yeah, exactly. So over here, you have to see, like, okay, or even pottery. Pottery is also
yeah.
a job, isn't it?
Yeah.
Example. These are, though, I have brought those
jobs,
examples.
Yeah, skillful.
Which are like, yeah, skillful.
Not seen
job.
In the society as some,
not seen,
like, good status.
This is
jobs.
Not like an academical style way.
Yeah.
yeah? Where
yeah.
you go through all the studies and stuff and either you become
have
a doctor.
Have a particular stream and then.
Exactly.
It's
so this is a kind of skillful
value.
Job. Exactly. So over here, the parents are like, oh my God, how is my child going to survive in this particular world, like this so much technological world and stuff like that. So over here, if the teen or the child, when he grows up, has good strategies for this particular job, okay, you know, for everything, there is wood. In every house, there is wood. In every office, everywhere, I would say, there's wood. Okay, be it a table or chair or whatever, you see, there is wood being
yes.
used, yeah? So here, if the teen is having the child is having a lot of interest in that particular job or whatever, then make him study his academic studies. So on the sideline, make him,
let him
also work and go ahead with the skills as well, isn't
right.
it? Yeah.
Let's take a short break here and think about the insights that you shared so far, and we'll be back in a while.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Islamic Upbringing. You're listening to Iran Radio, and we are exploring the strategies that could help improve motivation in your teens. So yeah, we're saying like sometimes teens are interested in some of the technical jobs that you may not see good because of the societal pressures or values that the society has imposed on them. But then your teen, however, is interested. Pavel Liaquat was saying if they are in the academic session, let them do the same in on the sidelines. Let them live their talents.
Yes. So, you know, actually I had a lot of keen, I had a lot of interest in finding out the jobs of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and also the prophets alayhi salatu wasalam. So what they used to do in order to survive.
Yeah,
of course, they have to get an income, isn't it? For their survival, for in order to provide for their families,
right.
Example. So, alhamdulillah, like, of course, I'm still working on it. The first example which I have taken into consideration is the work of carpentry.
Yeah.
So, a carpenter is someone who cuts wood and stuff for their livelihood.
Yeah.
And one of the prophets, who is very famous, one of the famous prophets, of course, and one of the Ulul Azm, like one of the very greatest of prophets, I would say, who used to do carpentry for his living, was Prophet Isa alayhi salam.
Right.
Jesus Christ. So Isa alayhi salam, or Jesus, used to do carpentry. So his profession was carpentry. So he was a carpenter. So you see, it's like nothing, oh my God, being a prophet, he's doing carpentry, is nothing shocking, okay?
Yeah.
Number two, Prophet Idris alayhi salam used to be a tailor.
Used
to stitch clothes of of people, and he used to get income, or he used to earn through that means.
Yeah.
Prophet Dawood alayhi salam was an ironsmith. So he used to melt iron, he used to make things and everything.
What a difficult job.
Yep. So he was a prophet. He used to do, he was a hadi. He was a, like, he used to guide people as well.
Yeah.
But still, on the other hand, he used to work.
Yeah.
Prophet Sulaiman alayhi salatu wasalam was the king himself. Okay.
Yeah.
So as the king, of course, there was this thing called, okay, if he is the king, he should be getting something. Okay. As a hukuk, like example, he's taking he's taking the whole kingdom into his hand in order to look after the kingdom.
Yeah.
So he should be getting some as kind of salary to him.
Yeah.
So he's looking after everyone's affairs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like what are the people doing?
Management.
Like, yeah. Management.
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, exactly. Good word.
Same.
So, and of course there are the prophets who had other professions. And the main profession of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was he was a businessman and also a shepherd.
Also a shepherd, yes. Thank you for exploring those topics here. And that really gives us another vision to the world of skill, the world of talents, where our teens can explore their talents more.
Inshallah.
Thank you for that. And thank you, dear listeners, for being with us, for listening. And that was all for today's episode. Take very good care of yourself and also of your teens, and listen to their skills, their talents. Open communication is always a key. Thank you. Until another episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
welcome to the Israel Watch, which has been monitoring the repercussions of the ongoing aggression against Lebanon and its impact on the settlers in the north. It also examines the return of the northern settlers amid continued violations of the Gaza Agreement, renewed air and ground attacks on Gaza, missiles launched from Yemen, and internal protests against Netanyahu, and other key topics for commentators and analysts in Hebrew media. We discuss these issues with Mr. Ali Rizek, security and political analyst here joining us. Thank you very much for joining us in this episode.
Thank you.
Given the recent Israeli escalation, it appears that Netanyahu administration's policy of resettling settlers has suffered a setback. Settlers have confirmed that they will not return due to what has happened and what may still happen, as they do not feel secure in the settlements. How do you expect the situation to actually unfold on the Lebanese-Israeli border?
I think that at the start, when these five rockets were launched, we saw the Israeli disproportionate response. It was way more than what actually took place. It was a very excessive reaction. Mm-hmm. I think that there were fears at the start that this might lead to an all-out war similar to the one which we saw during the September-November period of last year. It appears, fortunately, that that scenario has not actually taken place. Mm-hmm. And we did hear reports that President Joseph Aoun received some guarantees from the Americans.
But they reached to Sur. I mean, they reached to Tyre. Yes, not only to areas at the borders. They extended.
Yeah, they did extend. But again, it's not the full-fledged war which we saw in that period after the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. So it appears up until now
that... You think it ended there?
I think it's ended in terms
as
of...
As a reaction for the launching the five rockets.
In terms of having a limited scope war, it's like the Israelis, I don't think they're going to enter a full-scale war, but I think that these pinpoint attacks, like mm-hmm. we saw yesterday even, in Ait Hashar, these are going to continue. So the security intelligence war, which Israel has waged against Hezbollah, and we have to admit... This type of warfare, they have achieved some significant successes, the mm-hmm. Israelis, assassination, security warfare, and I think they're going to continue.
And that's the message that they want to send across, in your opinion? Or they just want to say this is a retaliation? Or there are other messages that they want to send, that we are always willing to break the borders and break the rules and enter?
Israel is waiting for any opportunity, any excuse to escalate even further. What happened, by the way, with these five rockets, this is not the first time that such incidents happen. Even before October 7, we used to see these rockets and missiles landing in open areas. Mm-hmm. Israel would initiate a very limited response.
But this time it extended.
This time it escalated because it believes that the momentum, the strength is on its side after what happened. And so I think that this security war is going to continue by the Israelis.
Okay.
Now, in the long term, I think that the Israelis are making a grave mistake, because what this is doing is it's actually weakening the Lebanese state.
Exactly, because the Lebanese state is at the front
President Joseph Aoun, mm-hmm. Prime Minister Nawab Salam.
And that's what Hezbollah said. Hezbollah said that this is the responsibility of the Lebanese government to actually secure the borders and take the necessary decisions. Okay. However, the Hat Shmona settlement Council, located on the Lebanese border, confirmed that the return of settlers has become difficult after rockets were fired from southern Lebanon. How big of an issue is this for Israel domestically, Ali? Because we have seen the massive protests over there, and also obviously these settlers are unable to return to the settlements, no matter what justifications or qualifications or all the things that the government sends to them.
Netanyahu already has his fair share of problems with the dismissal of the Shin Bet chief. That's led to an uproar amongst a significant segment of the Israeli settlers. There are various issues. Netanyahu is also being accused of running a dictatorship, autocracy, etc.
Corruption.
This is going to further increase the domestic front against him. Now, I'm not saying that the majority of the Israelis are against him. I'm saying there's a significant segment that is against him. One important thing when we see such reports, this dispels the notion that because often, especially in Western mainstream media, what is said is that Israel has achieved has made very big achievements, it's dealt very strong blows, etc. These kinds of issues aren't shed light on in the Western mainstream media. So I think this reveals, it gives us a more accurate picture of what is taking place, and it isn't necessarily that rosy scenario which some people make it out to be. And for Netanyahu in particular, because as we know, Netanyahu's reputation before October 7 used to be Mr. Security. That was his strength, which he used to distinguish himself.
And now many, as you're highlighting, are going to the streets and doubting that strength, doubting that character.
Exactly. So I think this will add to the domestic dilemma that Netanyahu is facing now. Is that going to have some dramatic repercussions? Will it lead, for example, to his downfall? That, I think that remains
to be seen. But you highlighted that there are a majority of the Israelis still support Benjamin Netanyahu, despite all these protests that we're actually highlighting.
There is a large segment.
And we're seeing, because these are the largest in the history of Israel till now.
There is a large segment who do support Netanyahu, yes. The Israeli settlers, or quote-unquote Israeli society, they've been drifting to the right.
Yes.
Continuously increasing.
Even domestically, even the people, not only the government, you're saying.
Indeed. Now, that's not necessarily, by the way, it might be good for Netanyahu at this time, but it's not good for Israel in the long term. Because I think that if this trend continues, Israel is going to resemble, I think it already does, resemble South Africa apartheid.
Yes.
And we know what happened to South Africa in the end. In the end, the apartheid regime was dismantled. Now, what the Israelis had an advantage, which the South Africans didn't have, the white South Africans, is that white South Africa didn't have an Israeli lobby or a pro-South Africa lobby in Washington like the Israelis
had. Didn't have an open agenda of support by the Americans also.
Exactly. So I think that in the end, in order for there to be a real collapse, because a lot of people speak about Israel approaching collapse, etc., I think that day will come. Most probably when the Americans seize their support for the Israelis.
Okay.
And I don't see the Americans seizing their support for the Israelis. One thing which might happen is that the Americans are going to have more pressing priorities which overweigh or more important for them. Like, for example, China is more important for America than protecting Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So the more we enter...
But up till now, we do not see that. We've seen a massive support for the Israelis and a lot of attention given to the files of the Israelis. And the biggest proof is the protection of Israelis against Yemen.
Exactly, yep.
And
so
launching
hasn't come yet.
Yes. Israeli social media platforms reacted to the aggressive escalation against Lebanon. Here are some of the comments from Zionist activists.
Yuri Tsafan. There is one thing that should be clear after the war with Lebanon. We must not entrust our security to others. History teaches us that Jewish settlements should only act based on facts on the ground and ensure security accordingly. What applies to the Galilee and the Golan also applies to Lebanon. Matty Gill, we must act wisely and proactively toward Lebanon. There is an opportunity to bring it into the Abraham Accords. George Heskin, the most important question today is whether the security arrangements they reached will allow Hezbollah to recover and regain its capabilities within 2 or 3 years.
What stood out for you in these comments, Sadi, when you look at the social life of these Israelis?
This just takes me back to what we were just discussing, that Netanyahu enjoys support. I think a lot of these comments appear to be in sync or consistent with the general approach taken by the Netanyahu government. If I'm not mistaken, there was a reference to normalization between Lebanon and Israel.
Obviously, even the society is pushing for it, not only the Israeli government.
Exactly. I think that's pretty far to be a normalization between the Lebanese and the Israelis. Israel remains an enemy of the Lebanese state.
But there are a lot of voices, domestic voices inside Lebanon, domestically speaking, that they want that to happen.
Well, there are domestic voices. I don't think that these domestic voices represent the majority.
Okay.
I think that the majority, it's clear that they don't support such acts. If that were to happen, if there was going to be a normalization, well,
obviously that's the dream of the some Israelis.
That's going to lead to some very, very severe domestic strife, I think, within Lebanon
within
itself
Lebanon.
And very sharp divisions.
Yes.
I don't think, by the way, that President Joseph Aoun in any way whatsoever is supportive of any kind of normalization, despite the fact that he is supported by the Americans and that he came to the presidency upon the approval or the...
Because also it's against the Constitution at
It's against the Constitution.
Okay.
There's been too much bloodshed by Israel for that to happen.
Okay. Moving on to Gaza, where a former Israeli army spokesperson warned against waging a full-scale war against Hamas in Gaza before securing the release of the captives. Is this true? Is Israel actually strengthening Hamas without realizing, in your own opinion? Because here the host actually asked him, well, Hamas feeds on the humanitarian aids, and humanitarian aid is not allowed to enter to Gaza.
I think it is strengthening Hamas, the Israeli approach in general. And I think that the more we see the Israeli politicians or the political elite shifting to the right, and the more this is translated into extreme policies, the more that is going to strengthen Hamas. I think that an important phenomenon is that the rise of figures like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich,
yes,
that undermines the traditional parties which were relied upon to broker peace or to make peace, like the Palestinian Authority.
Mm-hmm.
So the rise of the right wing, that strengthens the resistance, and it undermines the so-called moral players, or the moderate, players, like the PA. So it is undermining.
Why? Because it's rising a lot of voices that is supportive of Hamas against this Israeli extremism that you're highlighting.
Not just that. The Israeli extremists, even verbally, they say we don't want any role for the PA. We want to expand the settlements. So even verbally, they don't pledge to reaching any settlement or any accommodation with the Palestinians. That weakens the Palestinian Authority, because the Palestinian Authority's approach is, let's try to deal with the situation through negotiation.
Politically.
Through talk.
Yes.
With these kinds of people, with all Israelis it doesn't work, but especially with these kinds of right wing who are not ready in any way and who have a very narrow ideological approach.
And they're not even accepting a two-state solution negotiations. They're not even accepting mediators to actually move forward and come up with reasonable results for both sides. To that extent, you're highlighting.
Yeah, and there's another factor. We heard Antony Blinken, the former American Secretary of State, he said that the number of people Hamas has recruited equals the number of people it has lost during the ceasefire, the temporary ceasefire.
15-month
war.
Okay.
So that's also another factor. I think that due to the excessive violence and massacres, people now...
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, we're interrupting our normal programming today to bring you live coverage of International Quds Day rallies and marches taking place throughout the world. Millions of people literally across the world are set to take part in rallies and marches today in support of the Palestinians, in particular the Palestinians of the besieged Gaza Strip. Today, the last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan, is International Quds Day. We now go over to Press TV headquarters for live coverage of rallies and marches on World Quds Day.
Would countries such as the U.S. have a veto power in the U.N.? But what Imam Khomeini had in mind was an international organization for the oppressed across the world, that all the oppressed, everybody who wants to rise up against occupation, who wants to rise up against Western hegemony, that they are united and they can do so. In various ways, what Imam Khomeini did, now we know, for instance, when with the events of the Den of the Espionage, when what they called U.S. diplomats, and of course they were American spies, in the U.S. embassy in Iran, when they were taken because of their spy activities, Imam Khomeini immediately released, he ordered the release of women, and he ordered the release of black workers, because he said that these African Americans, they have been oppressed by the West. So in every move along the way, he always showed support for the oppressed across the world, like regardless of what their religion was, regardless of what their nationality was, because he believed it's a common, basically, interest that for all the oppressed in the world to be able to unite against the world's biggest military powers, against those running the biggest mainstream media. And so Quds Day is one of the examples, one of the and perhaps the most well-known, because he started this whole, call over 40 years ago. And at the time, actually, Muslims of the world had nothing like this. And people were not informed in the way that they had to be. But now Quds Day is actually held in various countries, and not only by Muslims. And millions across the world march on Quds Day. What Iranians have been doing that for over 40 years, but it's new to certain other regions who are starting to understand the importance of standing up to the Zionist regime more than ever. Now, what Imam Khomeini called Israel, and of course, the Zionist regime could have been called many things, right? Because they were terrorists, there are many labels that could be correctly placed on the Zionist regime. But Imam Khomeini called the Zionist regime a cancer. And what the cancer is that if you don't stop it, it will spread all over your body. And that's what has happened. In fact, in his various speeches, for instance, in one he said that Israel will not suffice to the land it has taken. If it's not stopped, it will continue to get more land. One day it will be Lebanon, one day it will be Syria, and one day it will be Iraq. And now, some 40 years later, what we are seeing, of course, because, of course, before that, they were already hitting Lebanon, but now we see that how much of Lebanon they're trying to take over. We see that they have taken over various parts of Syria already, and they are threatening Iraq. So basically, the prediction came very true, that this cancer will continue to spread. And that's why Israel, the Zionist regime, was basically singled out. And we know Israel, the Zionist regime, is a bastard child of colonialism. It's the entity that basically applies colonial policies in the region. And they have infiltrated various organizations, various governments across the world. They were even trying to get into the African Union, be part of the African Union, you know, and, you know, they have tried to infiltrate various, you know, we have across the world. So it's not only the Palestinians being oppressed by the Israeli regime, and it's not only the Lebanese, it's not only the Syrians, you know, it's not only people in this region, but also people across the world have their government infiltrated by the Zionist regime. We know about the power and the influence of the AIPAC. We know how much power it has over American senators. Basically, they have to pledge allegiance to the Zionist regime in order to basically be able to be active for the interests of their own people. And obviously, that's why the interests of their own people never comes first. So this cancer that Imam Khomeini talked about in 1979 has continued to spread, has continued to infiltrate governments, countries, has continued to infiltrate universities even across the world. Now we know that university students in the Western world, where, you know, freedom of speech has always been talked about as it's basically, you know, it's a pillar of freedom. It's a very important pillar of the Western civilization. And what we see today is that Palestinians, and not only Palestinian students, we see American students, Palestinian students, students from across the world who are in the U.S., either because they were born there or because they gained residence because they were so, they received scholarships, they're being kicked out of universities because of voicing opposition to the ongoing genocide in Gaza. So today, more than ever, we see the infiltration of the Zionist regime. And that's why today, more than ever, there has always been millions protesting in Iran against the Zionist regime. But today, we know millions more have joined them across the world.
Right, Mayim, as our viewers are watching live footage from different major cities in Iran, mainly the two cities of Bandar Abbas and Mashhad, we know that the official beginning time was supposed to be 10 a.m. in Iran. It is still 15 minutes from it, but at the same time, you can see the people of Iran, the eager crowd in millions already out onto the streets celebrating this holy event. Mayim, I want to talk about the history of the Al-Quds Day. Vic, as you already established in your first part of the talk and the conversation, the historical context of the Quds Day is inseparable from the Iranian Revolution of 1979, an event that fundamentally altered the geopolitical dynamics of the Middle East. We can say that by initiating Quds Day, Ayatollah Khomeini aim to elevate the Palestinian cause from a broader regional Arab issue to a central concern for the entire Islamic world, even the entire world, don't you think?
Well, of course, it became also very much the issue of the world, because more and more people realize that it's not only about Palestine, that this occupation will spread. Now, we know that there has been talks about the map of the greater Israel. Now, what is the map of the greater Israel? It basically has all of Jordan. It has parts of Egypt, parts of Saudi Arabia. It has Lebanon. So basically, all of these different countries, they're trying to take over. And they call it the greater Israel. But what they have done is that they have worked out step by step. They haven't decided, you know, at a time they were talking about a two-state solution. They were saying, oh, don't talk about eradicating, because Iran from the beginning was talking about eradicating the occupation. It said there should be no Israeli occupation, that all of this land, all of these settlements that have been built illegally, they should basically be diminished, that those intruders have to go back, the settlers have to go back to the countries they came from, and there has to be a referendum that people of Palestine should decide. And of course, Imam Khomeini, in his speech, he mentioned every religion in Palestine. He said Palestinians, whether they're Muslim or Christian or Jewish, and those in exile, should basically, and Imam Khomeini also says this, that the today's leader of the revolution also says this, that those in exile have to come back, and they have to all have a vote, have a say in the future of their own country, that this is their country, and they have to choose what kind of leadership it has. But what the Israeli regime has done was that it would take steps one by one and not show its true plans. You know, later some various Zionist leaders talked about how, to begin with, they had no plans for a two-state solution. They would have never agreed with a two-state solution, but at the time, they were talking about a two-state solution in order to make sure that there is going to be an entity called Israel, and then later they would expand, which, you know, what they have done. So with the West Bank, for instance, it was the Palestinian Authority, and now we see how the Palestinian Authority is actually has worked with the Zionist regime to destroy the Palestinian resistance without, of course, success. However, we see that, you know, in the beginning, they were not attacking the West Bank in the same way that they were attacking Gaza. And now that they are, they feel that they're done with Gaza, and of course, you know, they haven't been able to destroy Hamas. They've only been able to spread it further. But now they're going after the West Bank. Now they're hitting South Lebanon. They're killing Lebanese people. Even after the latest ceasefire in Lebanon, they have killed over 100 Lebanese people, and there has been, you know, very little, if any, international outcry for them to stop. So they take one piece of land, and at the same time, when they take that piece of land, they tell others in other parts that they are planning to occupy that this is not about you. We're only taking this little piece of land that is actually for our ancestors, that, you know, they have come up with this whole ideology that, oh, we're not safe anywhere in the world. We have to have this specific land, and this land that, you know, we were in a few thousands ago, then we can go back. And this is basically what they're trying to do. So what we see actually, and we see interesting examples of it. One of the examples was that as the Israeli soldiers were trying to go into Lebanon, and then they did, what they were doing was they were, of course, destroying Lebanese homes. And they were destroying Lebanese homes mostly in the south, because that's where the resistance is. So as they're trying to destroy resistance, they give the others the message that our problem is only with the resistance. And of course, what they call is, you know, they call them terrorists. They say, because these terrorists are basically are a concern to us, because they kill us, then we have to destroy them. But what came out, one of the footages that came out, was Israeli soldiers burning the Lebanese flag in Lebanon. Now, what the IOF did, they immediately slammed the Israeli soldiers for doing so. Now, this is really interesting, because the IOF hasn't slammed its soldiers for murdering babies, for murdering pregnant women, for targeting, for sniping children, for bombing schools and hospitals. Of course, these were all a plan that, you know, they want to cause fear in the hearts of people so that they would not resist. But why would they slander soldiers for merely burning a flag, the Lebanese flag? And of course, Lebanon is in the map of the greater Israel. They plan to occupy the entire land. So, but they slam it because to send a message to those in Lebanon who still haven't realized that this is also their fight, to tell them this is not your fight, to tell them that you should not support the resistance, that if you allow us to wipe out the resistance, then we will basically leave you be and you're going to have peace and security in your own country. As they're bombing Lebanon, as they're assassinating Lebanese people in their own country, they're telling others in that same country that, oh, you know, we recognize the basically the importance that this land is yours, that, you know, we're not going to even burn your flag. But what's actually happening is that they're going step by step, and every time they destroy resistance, every time they basically manage to kill and kill more resistance fighters, they will go one step ahead, they will take more homes, they will take more land, and they will limit people further and further. And we see what's happening today. We see how they have taken land in Syria. And of course, you know, when they disarm a country, when they disarm a resistance, what they do is they then invade the country at peace, just like what the U.S. did to Libya. Now, before, you know, the fall of Libya, what the U.S. there were so many talks about, you know, human rights violations in Libya, and the mainstream media was basically preparing the minds of the people for this invasion, and, you know, they were talking about all of these violations that the U.S. needs to, as usual, free a nation from a dictator. And what happened after the fall of Syria, you know, basically selling slaves on the street under the daylight. This has become normalized, and, you know, and now the U.S. is free to take away Libyan oil without any problem, without anybody resisting, because there's so much insecurity. And of course, what they have been doing is they have been arming various terrorist groups. They have been creating various terrorist groups that, if your audience actually looks into the funding of various schools, so-called Islamic schools, but really, you know, basically raising Takfiri terrorists to later go and join Daesh, or what is known as ISIS as well. And what we know now is that they have put a former ISIS leader in charge in Syria. So this all goes hand in hand. You know, they prepare the ground. They create these other pockets, and then this is just great because it's now Muslims fighting Muslims. Now they can talk about, you know, the Daesh, it's Daesh who are supposedly Muslim killing other Muslims, but whereas it's actually the U.S. plan, the American plan, the Western hegemonic plan for the region. And now we see why the Daesh and all of these various terrorist groups, so-called Islamic groups, have no problem with the Zionist regime. They have no problem. We see that the Syrian leadership right now has zero problem with the Israelis occupying parts of basically parts of Syria and creating their own sections and trying to basically implement their own policies. And of course, they have, and this happened because they have already destroyed as much as the weaponry of the resistance. So first they disarm the oppressed, and then they bomb them and steal their land and steal their resources. So, but what Imam Khomeini saw for the people over four decades ago was that people, the oppressed people, those who have very little power, seemingly, if they unite, they can defeat the greatest powers in the world. Because when Iranians also united, they were able to oust a regime that was put in place by the U.S. And now U.S. at the time was not in this weaker state that it is now. It was a very powerful, it was basically much more of a world power at the time. But Iranians still managed to oust the regime it had put in place. They still managed to fight for 8 years. And against the Ba'athist invasion of Iran that was supported and funded for and given weapons for by the U.S., by the West, by various world powers, in order to destroy the resistance of the people. And what Imam Khomeini said, what basically the Islamic Republic was based on, they said, you know what, we're not going to be oppressed by the Eastern powers. We're not going to be oppressed by the Western powers. Neither Eastern nor Western, but the Islamic Republic. We're going to be independent. And actually, Islam, now, Islam in its true form is actually a very political religion. You cannot be a Muslim and not care about the murder of your brothers in a different country. As Muslims, it's actually your responsibility to join together and stand up against oppressors. You cannot just pray and fast and consider yourself a Muslim. This is not enough, you know. So if you, we have various sayings like the hadith that says, you know, one who wakes up and is not concerned in the morning and is not concerned about the matters, about what's happening to his Muslim brothers, is not a Muslim. So this is the ideology, this is Islam in its true form that Imam Khomeini started. Basically, it was started in Iran with the support of people from their leader, Imam Khomeini, and then he was able to implement it in Iran. And so what he did, he called for that same unity across the world, because without the unity, the oppressed, who often have much lesser money, much lesser, I mean, of course, in their hands, because, you know, we have all these resources, but they often have much lesser money, they have much lesser weapons, and they have a much smaller voice individually. But when they unite, they're, Imam Khomeini believed, and we can see today, that they can actually push back the biggest powers in the world.
Right, Mayam, as we speak, our viewers are watching live footage from all around the country, all around Iran, in different major cities. And the huge crowds, you can see the huge crowds, the long line of people in Mashhad, the street, the avenue is packed. We had already images from Tehran also, which was very impressive. Huge crowds are up there in Bandar Abbas and Shiraz as well, and in so many other different cities and towns, small or big, all of them, people are spontaneously gathering in the streets, walking and marching and shouting, showing their solidarity with the people of Palestine. And as you just said, the International Quds Day is a day that transcends borders and unites people of conscience in defense of the oppressed people of Palestine. The thing is, the observance of Quds Day spans many countries, particularly in the Muslim world, where demonstrations, marches, and speeches are organized to reaffirm support for Palestine. These events often feature calls for the liberation of Al-Quds, the recognition of the Palestinian sovereignty, and an end to Israeli occupation. The thing is that, especially over the past 2 years, we've had a lot of rallies in different big cities around the world, in the collective West, in the global South, all over the world. We've had rallies of the people, freedom-seeking people of the world, shouting for the freedom of Palestine. And that was kind of surprising to the West. And I think the mainstream media was taken aback by the immense presence of people in the streets in the Western countries. That was really, really important. Now, can you tell me, Mayam, regarding the fact that, before getting back to Mayam, we have right now our correspondent Naka Hamed joining us from Ramallah. Naka, what can you tell me of what is the situation right now in the International Quds Day in Palestine, in Ramallah?
Yes, Bahman, well, now we are standing at Qalandia checkpoint to the south of Ramallah, which is to the north of occupied Al-Quds, where thousands of Palestinians have been pouring in since the hours of the morning to go to and to try to reach towards the holy city of Al-Quds over here. Well, as this day, Friday, this is the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan, where Palestinians, everyday Palestinians, try to reach out to their city and to be present inside Al-Aqsa Mosque, to to prove that this city, no matter what de facto situation is being imposed upon this city remains Palestinian, remains Arabic, and remains Muslim. As thousands of Palestinians, as we have, as I've just said, are trying to reach towards occupied Al-Quds. This is one of the most intense, if we are to call it this way, checkpoints towards occupied Al-Quds. Major security security measurements over here. Palestinians, as much as there is Palestinians going into Qalandia checkpoints, there are tents that are going out, being sent out without being able to cross